today. Please welcome Andy Ward, who will be talking about asymptotic safety and presumptive malformality.
Well, first, let me thank the organizers. Never do I have it all. Yes. Let me thank the organizers for giving me this opportunity and for arranging this very interesting meeting to speak about the developments which I've been associated with that have some connection to the subject. And since I realize I'm talking to an audience that may not have followed the last several years of this effort on my part, I will proceed with some introductory part of the talk, and then I'll review finding formulation of the theory that I'll be extending into what I've been calling Wiesum quantum gravity, and I may have to at some point improve on that name. And then I want to look at how it connects in with asymptotic safety, especially with the work of Bonanno and Professor Reuter, and then some concluding remarks. Now, these are some of the papers, if you get a copy of the transparency, that you can have a look on to, I think we're going to post the transparency on a website that people can
to the
on the website.
Oh, yeah, with the video.
Okay.
So let me now proceed into the introductory remarks to try to bring us up to where we are. As we know, the Newton law continues to be the one that, from the quantum field theory standpoint, we don't really have an agreed upon solution. Now, we do have the string theory people who claim they have solved the problem. They just don't know which solution we're supposed to use out of their tens or 500 and counting. But if you're talking about phenomenologically correct, that means having been confronted with a prediction from experiment and past such, we don't really have that. We know how to do classical theory is extremely well tested, I would say, in the large distance limit. And therefore, I think you can say that this is sort of leftover business of the 21st century if you're a field theory teacher, which I am, because all of the other interactions that we know about, electroweak theory of Dr. Weinberg's and Bachar Shalom's solution, QCD, Wilczek, Pollitzer, and Gross, it's just quantum gravity theory, that field theory, which at one time, as Professor Weinberg was just noting, was in quite a bit of ill repute, actually has been tremendously triumphant, except for quantum gravity. So that's why I think the asymptotic safety work over the last decade has been so important. Now, in today's talk, I'm going to resurrect an idea that Feynman already introduced in 1960, sort of published in 63, and then elaborate on in some lectures he gave at Caltech, which I'm showing there as well. And the basic idea is that you should be able to treat quantum, gravity should just be another quantum field that has a spin two rather than one or half or zero. But its quantum fluctuations should be treatable. Einstein-Hilbert action should be able, therefore, to be treated as any other local Lagrangian field theory. And he then has proceeded to formulate it. And I want to take up the one point where he stopped, in all of those words I have there. He stopped because he tried to compute, looked into the loops, and he figured out how to make them unitary, but he didn't figure out how to make all of them finite. renormalizable or make sense out of them from a finite number of parameters. So that's why he stopped. Now, Professor Weinberg, as we're celebrating some 30 years ago, made this, of course he's made many brilliant statements, but this is one of the ones that he made. And he said, look, if you want to do this theory, you either need to work with an extended version of it, some kind of supersymmetry or super spring, or as we, people have done, change the space-time, some kind of extension of Einstein, or you should do some better work on summing up the quantum loops in the theory. And he already pointed out that while if you just take an eye view of resumming, in fact, in these non-Abelian theories, the requirement that the field constant respect that the spectral density over which you integrate, Kempfelein-Lehmann density, is always part of this, broken by the ghosts and the other quantization aspects of certain gauges. So in, just like in QCD, this thing does not have to be something that comes out less than one formally. And therefore, in principle, you can pursue this. And people have, are giving talks showing that this indeed is the case. I'll be giving such a talk. Composite gravitons was the third option he presented. He and Professor Witten killed that at one point with the famous Weinberg-Witten system. However, Dr. Witten has been able to find that the assumptions they made in killing the theorem are not always satisfied, so he's actually been able to construct what amounts to an example of course in the context of strings. But so this really could come back, not because the theorem is wrong, but because some of the assumptions in the theorem are not necessarily satisfied by the ball theories. And finally, asymptotic safety, which is the subject of this meeting, and I'm listing here the line of development that I'm going to be following, especially Buonanno and Reuter's work, but I I'll list other people who you've already heard about that have done more work as I go further along. That's not I don't mean that as a complete list of the people who've been working on asymptotic safety, for example, and you'll see that in some better a little better list of the characters. I hope I have some. If I don't, please excuse me if I haven't shown your name. So the idea is to resum, to do a better job on the calculation, and in this way realize what asymptotic safety says, which is that the solution to the UV problem is provided by the theory itself. The theory, although if you expand naively, as Feynman has started, looks like it's unrenormalizable. In fact, when you sum up the solution in an appropriate approximation to the exact result, it is in fact calculable. And I want to try to provide an alternative approach to that improved calculation by changing the units of perturbative expansion. And I'm going to argue, therefore, that the reformation cures the bad UV behavior. And as I'll show, we make much contact with the results of Buonanno and Reuter and others. For example, the fact that an elementary particle which is living inside of its short-field radius is not a black hole, although classically it would be, etc. So that's the basic idea of the talk. Now, Feynman's formulation is a very beautiful development. As you know, in this effort, he invented what we call Feynman-Fadel-Popov ghosts. He starts with the standard Einstein-Hilbert terms, and I could put other terms here, but somebody has proved I don't need to add probably but one more, and I would have a complete possibility of a start. I'm going to assume that's my starting point. I'll put the cosmological concept back in a moment. So we have the standard model Lagrangian here, generally covariantized by standard methods and Einstein's term, and usual definitions of kappa, the square root of 8 pi, times Newton's constant, et cetera. It's easy, the straightforward and well-known you can read in Dr. Weinberg's books how to make the standard model Lagrangian generally covariant. The curls are already covariant because of the symmetries of the Christoffel symbol. And we can introduce a differences of structure for the fermions, and pull back on the Gamma matrices on the tangent space, and therefore you can get those to work as well with an appropriate connection which can encode torsion if you want to, etc. So all of that is well known, and I won't belabor that part of it. What I'm going to do, though, is follow an example, something that Dr. Wilson pointed out when he was trying to solve QCD he just looked onto the gauge sector, and somebody asked me, why don't you put the fermions in? And he said, well, you know, if I know the fermions without putting the gluons in, it's not going to be confining. And if I show the gluons are confining, then I'm going in the right direction. So let me get rid of the fermions for the moment and focus on the gluon. So here I'm going to do the same thing. I'm going to put in one piece of matter, since I want to argue that spin can't be a part of my solution. If I get a solution that depends on the spin of the particle, I claim I don't have one. Because as you just saw, the whole difference between spin was kinematical. Still a kinematical. as Grobelberger would say, it's an inessential complication. And we do know that we're expecting a scalar particle with a mass of about 120 GeV. According to the left experiments, it can't be less than 114. So I'm going to put in what Feynman studied, namely a scalar massive field interacting with gravity, and treat that quantum mechanical system. And then he has worked out this expansion, which of course continues on. But the important thing to remember that at any finite order in kappa, there's only a finite number of terms up there, because this is a power series in kappa. So if you tell me to calculate an S-basis element to order kappa to the n, that only involves a finite number of local Lagrangian terms, just like we're used to in the standard model. So in principle, you should be able to apply standard methods to this Lagrangian, with the H being the fluctuation field, sticking with Feynman's gauge. He worked out the ghost in the gauge. This is why we call him by his name. I'll stick with that. And your main problem jumps you in the face as soon as you just try to calculate something this simple, the graviton, the scalar contribution to the graviton propagator at one loop. You see that it's plus 4 if you count to the degree of divergence. And you feel the two-point function allows you two subtractions. So if you try to apply normal renormalization methods, you're going to be left with, even if you take into account the gauge invariance, you're going to be left with an uncancelled divergence that you pick up. And that is why we say we can't renormalize the theory. Now, the thing that motivates my discussion, following Dr. Weinberg's idea that in asymptotically safe theory, gravity is a well-defined physically. We see it. We drop something, it falls down. We don't get infinities in the physical world from gravity that we know about anyway. So dynamically, the asymptotic safety idea says that there must be a dynamical aspect of the theory that changes what we look at when we see it from counting, power counting, from ordinary renormalization of a field theory. And what pushed me in this direction was the fact that the force is proportional to mass squared. In the regime in which we are having the problem, the deep UV, the mass squared we're talking about is negative. In field theory. And therefore, in some way of looking at it, it means there's a strong repulsion in the deep UV from the normal gravitational leading term now, the gravitational force, the large negative mass squared, to a particle propagating on the one hand from X to another to X prime in the deep UV. And that should therefore severely damp that propagator and cause the loop that you're integrating over to get to this virtual mass state to actually give a much smaller contribution than you would normally think it would give. Now, of course, in order to see that, it means that you need to be able to redo a better job on the propagator. If you just use what comes off of the tree-level propagation function, you'll never see this. It involves resumming the theory. So this is therefore what led me into the subject of trying to isolate that part of the theory that might have a chance now to be systematically resumed. Well, if you're looking for large logs, large effects, in quantum field theory, you find them either in the collinear regime, the UV, or the infrared. Now, the UV, you don't want to resum that, because I want to use the usual renormalization algebra on my various coefficients in the Lagrangian. So I want to treat those by the textbook renormalization theory. So that takes me over to the collinear and to the infrared. Now, in the collinear regime, we know in these non-abelian gauge theories, For example, in QCD, for example, where we also have non-abelian collinear singularities, you can do some resummation on them, but it's very difficult to make that resummation exact. You can pick up, you know, leading long, neck, leading long, etc., but it's very hard to make it exact. If you're trying to prove something that is a property of the non-perturbative solutions of the theory, you don't want to be using a method of resummation that is intrinsically approximate in its nature. So that, therefore, led me to the infrared. Now, in the infrared, it is possible, as you can read in Dr. Weinberg's, he has some section on this in one of in his field theory books, but we do have, in the infrared, the possibility of isolating that part of the Feynman diagram, which, in fact, can be infinitely resummed without dropping it. That means that we can just rewrite every S matrix element to all orders in kappa in terms of a resummed piece multiplying something that contains the entire rest of the theory and where we haven't dropped anything. So this would then be a candidate to re-express Feynman's problem and to really see if these effects would be sufficiently representative of that dynamics that we believe, at least some of us, is the source of asymptotic state. We, therefore, were looking for a dynamical realization of asymptotic state. That was the idea behind it. Now, to give you a little bit of how the reformation algebra is working, it works like this. If I just take one case where you may be familiar with it, the quantum electrodynamics example, the propagator function can be rewritten exactly in terms of this large infrared pieces and using any Frocki-Thurs famous paper. This is all well known. This residual here is not the normal step energy function, but it's the step energy function with all of this. This is an exponent properly removed so that there's no double counting. And I want to stress that this is an exact identity. If you expand out the Feynman series for this, Feynman series for this thing and for this, they disagree order by order and perturbation. Exactly. It's all orders. Now, this is the kind of thing that we're looking for, therefore, for quantum gravity. The important point is that we haven't really dropped anything. I mean, this thing here has everything that we didn't resum in it. If we go into quantum gravity, so these are the formulas. I mean, this is I'm not going into the derivation of this, but I just want to show the structure because you can read off from here what you would have to do, or you can look in Dr. Weinberg's book. So this is what we would do in quantum electrodynamics. If I want to do the same thing in quantum gravity, we replace the graviton, the photon propagator, with the appropriate graviton one for a sausaging. The charges go into the graviton charges, which, as you know, are four vectors. So in electrodynamics, the charge is E. The corresponding charge in quantum gravity is kappa times the four vector. You have a question?
It would be helpful. Could you just show what diagrams you're resumming? What diagrams are inside this S and in the B?
What diagrams are in the S and B?
Yeah, that would be very helpful.
The series is this, but only the infrared part.
So the next one is?
That's all of the loops, all orders and kappa. Well, those are gravitons.
And what about diagrams where there's a graviton going from a vertex and one of those loops down to the bottom line?
What about what?
So there are lots.
This is what you have when you have one loop.
Right.
This is what you have when you have two loops, plus all the other interchanges, and also when gravitons go on graviton. I mean, all two-loop graphs. So I didn't write all the two-loop graphs. You can write a two-loop graph like it. This one.
Right, yeah, that's right. So that's
sure, that's in there. Sure, all of them in there. The beauty of it is that once you make those substitutions,
you get an amazing result. Because whereas I used to just have a number up here for the external property just a charge, I now have kappa squared times k to the fourth, where the k is the external four vector. And if you do this integral, which you can do it, I mean, this is something that I make my living from, you can do this. And if you do this integral, you get this nice result here. And you see that I've written it in the DUV, so you can write that as minus k squared if you want to. You don't like this, or these are absolutely assigned. But in any case, you see that this exponent has a property that it's going to kill the propagator in the deep UV exponentially, you see. Now, that is a beautiful thing if you're trying to treat a polynomial interaction. Remember I said to any finite order in kappa, I only have a finite number of powers of kappa. Every student of elementary math knows that every exponential beats every power, no matter how big the power is. So, in fact, you get an immediate damping of all the loops in the deep UV. I did it with a mass. If you have the massless particle externally, it's a standard mass independent renormalization that you need to go to. And in that case, you get mu squared where I had m squared. Again, that's some standard methodology there. I won't bother with it. So you still get this exponential damping. And so all of the quantum gravity loops have all of a sudden become UV finite. Now, you can make a proof, you can formally prove, so here you do what I said, you split up the theory into a free part and then all, you have to sum an infinite number of interactions, but to any finite order, you only have a finite number of them, and so you can work with them, their powers of fields and their derivatives, they can be counted using methods invented by Dr. Weinberg and others, and you can prove that the irreducible parts split up into pieces in a Dyson-Swinger algebra for renormalization that's well known. And then you can go into those, and you'll find that you'll get this exponentiated propagator at least on one propagator in every loop. And therefore, every loop subintegration is finite. And then Dr. Weinberg has proved that the whole integral has to be finite using his theorem. So using Dr. Weinberg, I'm thinking. With me, all of the proof. Using Weinberg. So that means that the thing is consistent with asymptotic safety, as I'm going to show you. And here I have some more names, Dr. Rhythm, Water. There's some I still haven't listed yet. But I want to point out another thing that I haven't heard mentioned in this meeting yet. In the last couple of years, there's been an alternative development that I think supports the conclusions that people are going to be making in this symposium. And that is this hop-algebraic Dyson-Schwinger equation renormalization theory invented and it's been worked on by Clymer. Because what they show, what he's able to show, and let me just put a qualification in here. He has not shown this for the complete Einstein-Hilbert action, but only for the part of it where you don't, you just look at the pure graviton lines, external line, contributions. You don't, for example, I don't think he has any ghosts in there and things like that. Okay. But what he's been able to show is the thing is leg renormalizable, non-perturbatively. See, Dyson-Swinger equation is a non-perturbative equation. Now, what does he mean by leg renormalizable? It is true. He can write a hop algebra on the using basically a BCHD, but observing that there's left ideals, invariant left ideals. And using the structure of hop algebra, he's able to show that there are, while you do have an infinite number of infinite contributions to each S matrix element, you have an infinite number of relations coming from the hop algebra and the corresponding word identities. And when you put those infinite number of relations on the amplitude, you end up with only a finite number of independent constants in the theory, just as we're finding in this symposium. So that's another third argument that this is the right approach for quantum gravity. Some people have argued that I looked on the propagator, what would happen if I put in the vertex? There's a theorem for the vertices also, I'm writing it out here, this is more terms like this. what happens is this is subdominant in the Einstein theory because of the, it's always true that, that for the vertex, you're always looking where one of the lines is not going to infinity as large as the other, and that's enough to make it subdominant. It's still going very large, but not large enough to stop these two terms, this term, the square, this term, and the square, that term, still end up dominating this. So that doesn't change my conclusion. That was a point by Potemsky. And this is the kind of thing you have to learn how to calculate. Now, it looks a little intimidating, but you can get used to it. These are just the propagator, these are just this simple function here, you see. And so you have to get used to a little bit more algebra, you know, but with the computer, you can pretty much do any algebra these days. Okay, so that's sort of the introduction to the theory. I would like to now turn to the theory. I therefore I claim is consistent with expectations from asymptotic safety, that it cures its UV divergences dynamically. It's consistent with Primer's Hopf algebraic Dyson-Schwinger leg renormalizability result, which I think is very important because that's a totally different argument from what I was talking about here today. And giving the same kind of conclusion that we only have a finite number of parameters, although on the surface it looks like we have an infinite number. And the question is then, how do we make contact with observation? Somebody asked me, well, if you've got everything, all of the stuff calculable, why haven't you finished? Well, because I haven't shown that I have been able to predict so far a single number that an experimentalist has been able to miss. And to me, physics is an empirical science. And until you can predict something that the experimentalist can measure, and I'll even take both of these, you haven't solved in physics science. Maybe you have a nice piece of mathematics that I agree with. Okay, but you haven't solved in physics science. This is going now into the other graphs for the graviton. You see, you have to put it all in there. Ghosts and the like. One of the first things we found was that in the deep UV, we had a softening of Newton's potential with this Planck scale number. And it turns out if you Fourier analyze this, this is consistent with what has been found by Bonanno and Water. They have if you think of their prediction for the running Newton's constant, in terms of a 1 over a squared, we have essentially, by totally independent methods, come up with an a squared that is remarkably of the same size, given that I use totally different methods. And of course, they're not exactly the same because I put in matter and they did not. But the very fact that they're in the same ballpark says a tremendous amount. We get totally different ways of doing the calculation. We both get the result that there's a critical size for something to be a black hole in the theory, namely that if a particle has a mass of the order of the plate mass or less, it does not have a horizon because of the solution that they have found, namely that the Newton's constant vanishes fast enough as k squared goes to infinity, so that in fact we end up with no horizon for those types of elementary particles. That means the standard model particles are not black holes. We both get this result. We then go further. I go a little further. We both agree that at this critical value, the Hawking, Bekenstein-Hawking temperature vanishes, leaving a remnant. And then I can go a little further with the calculation. They probably could also, if you go a little further and join on inside and out, they didn't do, but if you do it using their metric formulation, this standard implementation of the metric space-time here, you can find that indeed the horizon is actually obviated, and this thing actually decays. And so I've told somebody asked me why wasn't I finished. I told them that the theory predicts Planck-scale cosmic rays. Now they told me, Mrs. Ogier and the people who look for that, that they have difficulty to see a Planck scale cosmic ray because it expands out so much beyond the limits of their detector. Only when they maybe put in this other hemisphere, they have something down in the south, and then they're going to put something in the north. Maybe now they can actually see such an event. And these, of course, would be rare. I haven't done any estimate of how often you could see that. But that's an example of the kind of thing that if I saw, I would believe I might have solved the problem, for example, you know, if I saw, if they saw something like that. Because that's about 9 orders of magnitude higher than the GZK bound that they're supposed to stop you from seeing things. Now we go into the what I think is one of the most exciting things that Bonanno and Rotter have done with asymptotic spacing, and I believe I corroborate, I believe I do, is I call it Planck scale cosmology. Yeah, I've got the lambda back. And what now we've already we both agreed that if we take k squared times g newton to infinity, we do get this g star that Professor Rotter was talking about. The question is, and they also show that if you write lambda in this way for lambda star, that this also approaches a fixed point in the DQV. And so I would like to check whether my approach reproduces the same kind of result. And I would like to check whether the relationships they use in setting up Planck scale cosmology are corroborated by my calculation, which is a completely independent assessment of the physics. It's just completely independent of what they were doing. So as far as the Newtons go, we know we agree. Not only that we get this G star, but we get a G star that's similar in size, especially when you consider the content of the two theories. So there we don't have anything to do. I'm just referencing their paper there, I think. Now, the thing that we need to do is we need to calculate in their framework. And let me just, I noticed he didn't say too much about this. Maybe they're going to later. This is the cosmology setup. This is the Robertson Walker, but now he's got, he's added the thing from running Newton and lambda coming out of the treatment that we now both have. I didn't tell you my lambda and p yet, but it's similar to his, into the equations. And then this is, of course, the k can be 0, 1, or minus 1. And he's a little tentative to say he, at the time that k equals 0 is one where we have a consistent solution for both Planck scale and non-Planck scale physics. K equals 1 and k equals minus 1, as far as I know, this is not the case. Now, he can tell you about whether that proves there is no such thing for k equals 1 and k equals minus 1. I'm not going to comment on that. The beauty of it is, you see, your sub-Planck scale, I mean, if you're thinking of where you're in the Planck, the beauty of it is that, you see, we go all the way down to zero here. This classical time is just a few times the Planck time. And for k equals zero, we have a consistent solution that joins on smoothly from, he has, so he and Rotter have a consistent solution, which joins on smoothly from the Planck, sub-Planck scale physics onto the, you know, the so-called classical regime where your quantum mechanics at the Planck scale is no longer the dominant physics. And I want to check, I already know that my G star is consistent with this. And this, of course, he's argued, and maybe somebody will explain that in the proceedings. Horizon flatness, scale-free Harrison Delvaux spectrum and entropy problems. The last I checked, and there may be some more, but all of those are on the table from pure Planck scale quantum mechanics. Okay, pure Planck scale quantum mechanics. So I think that's a fantastic result. I obviously would like to play a little bit.
So
what do I need to do? Well, the one thing I need to do is to show that I have a lambda that's consistent with the lambda that he's found in the deep UV of the theater. So how do I calculate lambda? My problem. And I use Einstein's equation, and then I point split the fields in this way and observe, therefore, that I can pick up the number I need from that equation using field theory methods. I told you I'm a field theorist, so if I want to do something, I'm going to use some field theoretic procedures. That doesn't mean it's necessarily the best way to do it. But you see, I get this beautiful thing here. And again, you can do this integral. And you see, this is the remarkable thing is that the integral brings down 1 2 pounds of the Newton. So I end up with my lambda behaving like his lambda. If you work this number out, this number is a property of the, now I don't know how, what, all I know is what we know. You put in a minus one for the fermion number, and you have the other one summed over the effective number of degrees of freedom of particle J. And the average of this one over lambda C, which is m squared over m Planck squared. So those things I can put in from the particles we know, but of course, since I'm going all the way up, let us hope that there's some particles I don't know about. Because otherwise, it's the end of, it would be the end of the subject. I mean, all we know is what we see. So let's assume this is wrong. But the thing is the most remarkable thing about it, to my mind, is the fact that, you know, when you put in the, when you put in the numbers, you can, you get a slide that, like this one. The cosmology results are holding in my approach. I mean, I don't have anything that I could find that contradicts anything they said about my realization of the limit of the theory and what they have found using the exact field space renormalization a la Wilson for the theory. So all of these problems, horizon, flatness problems, scarcity, spectrum, for distance fluctuations and entropy, all of that is solved following the Bonanno and Reuter. I'm reaffirming their solution. This is, understand that. Without having to introduce a scalar field. We don't have any mention of any implicon anywhere in if we actually put numbers in there, in the paper in which I was looking at their numbers, my numbers are qualitatively similar. I'm a little smaller on G star, but not very much, and very similar on lambda star. The main property, they can comment on this in the discussion that will follow, but the main property they use about these numbers, as I understood it, and they can correct me if I'm wrong, is the fact that, one, they were both positive, and two, one of them is larger than the other, as far as I understood. And the products are similar. The products, right. But I just wanted to point out that the main properties that they stated that they were the ones that I have here in the paper. Now there may be some other issues that we can go into in the discussion. Now the K equals ill solution, I promised to say something about calculating the coupling with constant, the one that the experimentalists claiming that they measured in the astrophysical journal. So let me honor that promise. Now this K equals zero solution, and as far as I know, that's the only solution that they have for both reasons. That's true. It has this nice property. If you calculate rho lambda, it's zero plus something of order 1/T, of course. And of course, it has all the other nice properties. But look at what that is. Now we know it's not zero because they have a number that's, you might think of as going like 1/T² or something in the appropriate units. So it's not zero, but it's tiny. And so, you see, the most amazing thing to me about this result is that I've been listening to all of my field theory lectures going back when I was a graduate student in Princeton all the way up and then participating in lectures. And every field theory estimate that I've ever heard, and this is a field theory based estimate of rho lambda, every one that I've ever heard was way too big. Every one that I've ever seen was orders of magnitude too big. As far as I know, somebody can correct me, this is the first time anybody has ever made this kind of estimate, and it's come out too small. Now, what does that tell you? that strongly suggests that if somebody, some clever young person in the room, will take a look at the two types of theory that we're talking about here, there's a chance they can meet in the place. There's a chance somebody can actually get the right answer. There's a chance somebody can get the right answer. So that's the one thing I wanted to point out, that was the most remarkable. Of course, right now this is unrealistic. You know, if you look into the details of their solution, it's not, you know, immediately, it's clear it's not the world as we know it. But I think this is a tremendous improvement in the situation regarding lambda, because this is coming out too small. So I'm finished over. Low lambda.
Value of lambda at very large scales?
Yes. It's a value of lambda at very large scales.
So the theory, therefore, that we're talking about following on the idea of lambda is really, I think, giving us an alternative view of how we do, what do we do with Einstein? Because we are now at a position where, of course, it may be true that the string theory people are correct and that you have to solve all these problems at once with a string, with a super string theory, where you have all of that there at once. But what this does is this opens up the possibility that you can treat those as separate problems. The problem of solving the quantum mechanics of Einstein and the problem of solving the unification of the other forces, these do not have to be one in the same problem. These may have separate solutions, which of course may be combined in some beautiful way by the string and some more elegant way of looking at things. The one thing I would say against that is that until recently, the string people argued that you really couldn't get the distances below the Planck scale. If you try to do it, duality takes you back out. They have these dualities in the theory so that, in fact, you really can't get below the string, below the Planck scale. In this theory, obviously, you can't. I mean, you know, there's nothing, as he was saying, we need some discussion about how you do it, but you certainly can go below the Planck scale. And I have to say, I find that rather appealing because I'm a reductionist. And if you're going to be a reductionist, you need to be able to keep going. This theory says you can't. Okay. That suggests that there is some ultimate theory. I've heard it mentioned here at least by Genesis. I have it up here again. In which this theory is presumably a part of it. We don't know what it is yet. But maybe using the things that we're going to be hearing about in this symposium, we will, in fact, be able to make progress on discovering what the TUT, the ultimate theory, might actually look like. And I want to say that maybe it is a string. I don't know what it is. But it's sort of suggesting it's not, because it really does have, you know, non-trivial physics below the Planck scale. In fact, way below the Planck scale. Something that is really not natural to the string approach. Okay. Although I understand it works. Now, the early universe studies may be able to test the predictions, and like I said, I mean, if we could get rho lambda to come out the way they see it, that would be. Then I might feel like I'm making some I've made some lasting contributions or something. Right now I feel that we're just scratching the surface, and Dr. Roy has said we have some issues we still need to deal with, but I think we've made a lot of progress. I like to say that this is now a minimal union of Bohr and Einstein. If I go back to my first transparency with Dr. Landler's four choices, I have not extended the theory. That's the beauty of the asymptotic technique. But of course, they put in all of the terms they need, but they finally only need three terms in the action at most, is what we're hearing. And we can get into how much that third term actually played a role in the solution. But the idea is that we did not change in principle the first two terms of the action. If we just look upon it as a consistent theory, we see that the table, the values that they get for the coefficients are not that different, you know, once they stabilize. So I would say that this is a minimal union of coordinates. We don't have supersymmetry in this. We don't have extra dimensions in this, except as a technical device that I use to calculate, do a calculation on things. It's certainly not in the entirely central way. There's so much dimensions in it. It really is the union of the original idea of support. We have a number of checks, but I consider these to be mainly formal ones, sort of postdictions that we see the elementary particles are not black holes. We have a tremendous agreement between the Guadagno and Rotter asymptotic safety phenomenology with the critical mass for the distance of a horizon, and then quantum mechanics stops it. And then I end up with Hawking radiation giving me Planck's positive rays, which I put pressure on the experiments to look for, and then finally look for that. You have to understand, they do show these plots where they do see the UZK depression, but then they have some extra straggling stuff. So they see they do see a knee if you want to, but they don't see zero. And so this is supposed to be something that's going to make something not just near the bound, but presumably it should make something much higher than the bound. That would convince all due to quantum loop effects. I think the Planck scale cosmology, I find the most intriguing part of it. We did this, of course, from first principles. Now, when I say that, if you look into the details of the phenomenon analysis, they have threshold functions, you saw them. They checked the sensitivity of their results to changing the shape of those functions and the like. You know, they've done a very good job on that. But it is, I think, important to have a completely independent calculation in which such things do not occur, give the same answer. I think that's useful. So that's why I said that. And this rho lambda equals zero is a really a good start to some extremely exciting days ahead, I think, because as I can see, any other field theory based method that I've ever tried to use to get a handle on what that number should be has come out to be orders of magnitude larger than what the experiment double circuits. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much for the interesting talk. We have time for a couple of questions before we start the general discussion session.
Yes, Lee.
Well, so there's a history to the idea that you could meet some quantum gravity and it be finite. And I'm wondering if you can mention how your work relates to that history. I mean, there was speculation of Arnowitz, Deser, and Misner.
That was using R squared terms. That was changing the
answer. No, not using that was a classical argument. Then there was a paper of Bryce DeWitt with some of the ladder diagrams and got an ultraviolet regularization. My impression, and maybe your work shows this is wrong.
These are not ladder diagrams.
Yeah, no. I've always understood that the combinatorics was that you could sum and exponentiate a subset of diagrams which had the right combinatorics as in the Abelian gauge theory, that basically had the same combinatorics as the Abelian gauge theory, but that the overall combinatorics is too hard to.
Now, this is the same kind of summation you did use in the Bloch-Nordsick method in quantum electrodynamics. Everything factorizes. The summation is just an exponential function.
This is not claiming that I didn't leave any non-abelian things in those residuals. When I have the exponent, sorry, this way, and then if I look into sigma prime has all of the problems of non-abelianness that you're trying to say. So that's why I couldn't put the whole thing. If I do this in quantum electrodynamics, if I do this in quantum electrodynamics, sigma prime does not contain any further infrared divergences. Okay? But in quantum gravity, that's not the case. There's still some stuff that's not abelian that's still in here, because it will not go into, it doesn't exponentially.
Okay, thank you. That's the point I was missing.
Yeah. Okay. So that's the difference.
Okay. Any further questions? Well, maybe I have one.
Yes.
Your setup is based on essentially resumming certain classes of Feynman diagrams.
Taking every Feynman diagram, pulling out the infrared part, that exponential.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not skipping anything.
What happens with the collinear part and the UV part?
They're still down in here. I have not touched them. I said I wouldn't touch them. Those will have to be treated, as we do with ordinary renormalization problems. But that's why I didn't touch them. The collinear part does not have this structure. I cannot use that part of the graph, the cycle-length of the X. You understand? Maybe not completely, but there's enough.
Yeah, so where's the two loop divergence?
The two loop divergence.
Is it? I mean, so what ate it up, I guess? That's what I'm wondering. What ate it up?
Not just two loop, all loop.
Right.
The fact that I have k squared plus m squared to the minus lambda times k squared plus m squared multiplying what used to be a two loop divergence. So when k squared goes to infinity, this falls faster than any power. Because it's an exponential. So the 2, 3, 4, all of them are fine.
Let me try to ask that again. So is the idea if I worked on the entire S matrix and added it together, then the infinities would cancel? Or is there something, I mean, is the fact that you've included scalars, is that crucial to it? The fact that when...
No, the fact that I included scalars has nothing to do with it. The statement is that this is a realization of asymptotic safety.
Okay.
If you start with a naive perturbative expansion,
mm-hmm.
you will see that you have all these infinities in the theory, order by order.
Right.
But these are artificial, because if you actually solve the entire series at once, these are not present, because they, and if you try to, so then how are they not being present? And I'm showing an example that if you actually rearrange the terms in the Feynman series and not treat them order by order, but actually sum through to the end, you see, you change something that's diverging into something that's converging. You understand? By the way, we had to do a similar thing to be able to do the Z line shape, because if the Z also, and this is a little less difficult, but the Z also, if you don't put its width in, it will have in, and you try to do a loop graph with a Z in it, you will see that it has a very unstable behavior. And if you write out the perturbation series for the Z particle without its width, you'll see that it just jumps all over the place. To make it stabilize, we have to sum through, this time it's Dyson's expansion, and we replace the propagator with a propagator with a width. And then it becomes a beautiful expansion that we can calculate to arbitrary accuracy. But without doing that, we have no chance of proving that we have the data at left consistent with the Z residence. That's a lot simpler, but it's the same idea.
And you can do this for 3 or 4 point functions also?
This is all functions. I don't need to do it for the. All I need is to show. My job was to show.
Yes, I understand.
That, but now you're saying, can I resum the 4 point function? If you resum the 4 point function, you do get a function out in front of it from the vertices. I think I showed that.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can rearrange it and make it more convergent in the infrared. Mm-hmm. For all of them, you may do this. You may do it, yes.
And for cross sections, after you could calculate and extract the infrared divergences of the final states.
Well, you could extract those infrared divergences that exponentiate. You can see that in Dr. Weinberg's book, actually. He has this in his textbook, what you're talking about. You can read that in his textbook.
Can you resum according to infrared behavior, but you apply it to the ultraviolet? So what's the idea?
I don't know. No, be careful. The infrared is for the entire amplitude. It's not just for the ultraviolet. This external line is arbitrary out here. This is not having anything to do with what I'm. This is the thing that controls where I'm at, whether I'm in the ultraviolet or not. This K is the thing that I'm working on in the infrared. It has nothing to do with the external momentum.
So that the ultraviolet divergence is somewhat also in this inner loop momentum.
And that's why they got killed. But this applies to arbitrary values of the external momentum. So in fact, I mean, this is a rearrangement of the contributions to the propagation between two points in the theory, in the UV. It is in the UV, and it's being generated by the fact that momentum limit of this propagator is sensitive to soft. I mean, that's one of the things that most people don't realize. Just because a particle is moving very rapidly doesn't mean that it doesn't know that it's charged. It still is charged. And in gravity, everything is charged because the charge is at four vector. And in fact, the stronger is the radiation, the larger the four vector, because the charge is the four vector. So in the beautiful thing, the thing about Einstein's theory, the soft graviton couples to the four vector of the particle. That means it couples more strongly to the particles in the UV than it does to the ones in the infrared, because it couples to the four vector. And the square of the four vector is much larger in the UV than it is in the infrared. It's just most people think of gravity, it's just a weak thing because it's you can't hardly see it. But in fact, it's just the opposite. In the UV, Einstein is not playing. I mean, the coupling is stronger between a graviton and a highly virtual particle because it's proportional to K mu. And K mu squared is larger. You see? It's actually larger.
Okay. So if there are no further questions, then let's please.